I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. World leaders can plan all they want, but they still have to keep pace with those things they can't control. Today's funeral of Yasser Arafat changes the balance of influences in the Mideast. Whatever happens today in the fighting in Fallujah might help or hurt Western attempts to bring democracy to Iraqis. And who in Europe might have predicted another 4 years of President George Bush? Into this squall of changing events, Tony Blair sails back into Washington once again, talking with President Bush about war and peace and trying to see if there's any common ground or common water between America and Europe. The historian Timothy Garton Ash imagines Blair's attempt to reconcile Texas and Belgium as that of a man standing astride two oil tankers that are moving apart, trying to hold them together with just the strength of his legs. Such a man, says Ash, is not a statesman. He's an idiot. It's a good thing, he concludes, that Europe and America are not oil tankers. And in fact, Timothy Garton Ash has some new ideas about Blair and Bush, America, Britain, and Europe, and that so-called special relationship. We'll get to those in just a minute. First, though, an invitation to you to join us this hour as we explore what's changed and what's new in the relationship between Blair and Bush. Do the two leaders still need each other? Is Tony Blair the only leader preventing a greater divide between America and Europe? And is George Bush ready to take steps to improve relations with his European critics? And what about the other way around? And is the press for peace in the Middle East the best place to start? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I said, we'll be talking with Timothy in just a moment. First, though, for the latest from the meeting of the two leaders, we have with us Richard Wolff. He's Washington correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
I wonder if you can help us with the two perspectives that we'll be looking at today. First of all, what's most important about this meeting for President George Bush?
Well, what's most important is Iraq, in a word, specifically Fallujah and the prospect of elections later this year. He wants to hold the coalition together, and the White House is acutely aware that Tony Blair has been under intense domestic pressure, including simply deploying troops to support, British troops in Iraq to support the operation in Fallujah. So he's looking to shore up that famous coalition of the willing.
And what about Prime Minister Blair? What's he looking for? What's most important to him?
Well, he has said that the most important challenge for the international community is actually not Iraq, it's peace in the Middle East. And with, obviously, Arafat's death, he is looking for something that he has pressed for many, many times before the war in Iraq, during the war in Iraq, and now, which is to kickstart, to put new life into the peace process.
You know, Richard, there was a time prior to the most recent American election and the war in Iraq when it seemed like President Bush really needed the help and assistance and support of Prime Minister Blair. Has that changed now? Is Prime Minister Blair looking for help from President Bush?
Well, Blair has something that Bush has just dispensed with, which is the prospect of an election. Blair is facing re-election probably next year. The timing is in the hands of the British government. That's the way the British system works. But everyone expects it to be next year. And he's facing something of an unusual position, which is that until now, he's had pretty much the support of not just the majority of his own party, but also conservatives, the opposition party in Britain. That has changed. The conservatives are now criticizing him, like people in his own party, for being a poodle, for not getting enough out of this relationship. Mm-hmm. So he really needs to come back with something concrete about the Middle East and to show that President Bush takes his concerns seriously.
Richard, thanks for starting us off this morning.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is Washington correspondent for Newsweek magazine. As I mentioned, Timothy Garton Ash is with us for the balance of the hour. He's director of the European Studies Center at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, and he's got a new book. It's called Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. He's joining us from a studio in Chicago. Hello, Timothy.
Good morning. Nice to be with you again.
Yes, nice to have you back. Now, let's deal, if we can, with a couple of things that are on the today agenda before we go to the long term here. Tony Blair, as Richard points out, has been so insistent that Mideast peace needs to be the world's number one concern. Does the funeral, the death of Arafat today, present much of an option for change?
Yes, it's clearly a huge opportunity and we have to grasp it. The Bush administration has said that Arafat was the biggest obstacle to restarting the peace negotiations. Arafat is now dead. you have to remember that the Palestinian issue is one of the biggest recruiting sergeants across the Arab world for al-Qaeda and for terrorism.
And so among the 1,001 reasons to say why Mideast peace is so important, why is it so important to Blair? Why now?
I've talked a lot to Blair about these issues, and he is a conviction politician. He rarely believes that this issue, and he's been saying this for years, is vital to transforming the balance of power inside the Islamic world between Islamic moderates and the Islamist extremists. But as Richard rightly said, and by the way, how amusing that the Washington correspondent of Newsweek is a Brit.
It's part of the bridge now, come on.
it's part of this extraordinary intimacy that we have between America and Britain, you know, in academic life, in culture, in journalism. It's amazing. But anyway, that by the way, as Richard rightly said, Blair has an election coming up. If he could show that he has got Bush to make peace in the Middle East, then he could say to the British electorate, you know, it wasn't all in vain. I got something out of it too.
Let's talk about this thing that you describe in your new book as the Blair Bridge Project. What is that? Start us off.
Britain is this extraordinary country. It is the place where Europe and America meet. You know, our ties with America are so intimate in, as I said, culture, journalism, academe, business, the military, the intelligence community, but also our ties with Europe in many ways even closer. So if America and Europe were to drift apart, were to divorce, we would be torn limb from limb, like a prisoner on the torturer's rack. The Blair Bridge Project is to try and keep Europe and America together again and to make Britain the bridge between Europe and America.
And how, Timothy, does that change with the re-election of President Bush? Because on one level, you could see that here in this country as an affirmation of the unilateral spin on a global approach that Bush brought to the White House. Certainly the reaction we've seen after the election from Europe reconfirms the distance that separates now America and Europe. So does it take on a new urgency?
51% of America, one has to say, from 48%. One of the problems is that I've spent 10 days now in the United States, and it seems to me that blue America is even more dismayed than most Europeans are. Many Europeans now say, so Bush is America and America is Bush. It makes it much more difficult. The prospects now of a further crisis of the West, a further alienation between Europe and the United States are, I think, much worse. And as someone who spends much of his time either defending Europe in America or America in Europe, I can feel the beginnings of the turn of the rack. I'm getting stretched already.
I wonder if it's a time for Tony Blair to, I suppose, as a gesture towards all those Labour MPs who fear that he's off in Washington being Bush's poodle once again, I wonder if it's time for Tony Blair to start to say in a more public way that he has these certain disagreements with Washington. Can that work for him?
I think he needs to relearn a good old-fashioned English word, no. It appears we have been, the British for decades have been practicing what I call the Jeeves School of Diplomacy, as in P.G. Woodhouse's novel. We play Jeeves the butler to America's Bertie Wooster, impeccably loyal and silent in public, but then in private we try to murmur words of wisdom into Bertie Wooster's ear. Is that wise, we mutter. The trouble is Bertie Wooster is no longer listening, or maybe it's Alfred and Batman. And I think it's time for us to give up on the Jeeves School of Diplomacy. Of course, we should continue to engage with Washington, but the key thing is to build a strong European voice, because it's quite clear, to change the metaphor, that the British tail can't wag the American dog. The asymmetry in power is much too great. But if Europe, speaking with one voice, says, we want to work with you, the United States, but not like this, you're going about it the wrong way, in Iraq or wherever, I think we would be listened to.
When you talk, though, about European power, is that economic power? Is that a recommitment to military power, an attempt to sort of expand influence? In what way, then?
You know, the great mistake of American neoconservatives is to think of power in purely one-dimensional terms, military power. And if you think power is only guns and soldiers, then America is a giant and Europe is a dwarf. But power is three-dimensional. Economically, Europe is the equal of the United States. That is clearly the case, and indeed, in trade negotiations, Washington treats Brussels as an equal. You remember that recently the European Union actually stopped a merger between two giant American companies, General Electric and Honeywell. We also have what Joseph Nye of your own city has, Joe Nye, has called soft power. That is the power to attract. You know, the European Union has doubled in size over the last 20 years, and our neighbors are literally lining up to join the European Union. So that is a major dimension of power. Turkey, for example, is doing everything it can. A majority is a Muslim country, is doing everything it can to try and be accepted as a member of the European Union.
You know, I've always thought that there was that depth of wisdom in Washington that understood how important economic power was in expressing America abroad. Are you saying that may have been subdued somewhat by the recent ascendance of the neocons?
You know, As I said, I've spent 10 days now in the United States, and I'm afraid to say one word keeps pounding through my head, and that's the word hubris, the pride that comes before a fall. Hubris, as you know, is followed by nemesis, and I do see in this Bush administration, and I fear particularly after it's re-elected, alarming symptoms of hubris, a huge overestimation of American power and America's ability to change the world on its own, and an accompanying underestimation of European power.
Timothy Garton Nash is joining us this hour from a studio in Chicago. He is normally at home in St. Anthony's College at Oxford, where he directs the European Studies Center. He's got a book called Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. When we come back after this break, we're going to talk about the word we. The word we is something that Timothy begins his book with, challenging those who read it on this and the other side of the Atlantic to figure out what it means today when we talk about the West. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This is the topic on many minds today as Prime Minister Tony Blair has his first encounter with President George Bush after the election. We're inviting you into our conversation about how that relationship has changed or ought to change. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Most of us have grown up with the notion of the West. And Timothy Garton Ash's new book, Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West, raises some provocative questions about that. He's here this hour to talk about those, though we do want to include you in our conversation. I'm going to start in Nashua, New Hampshire. Barbara's joining us on the phone. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. I just had a comment. I appreciate this topic. I'm not naive about the history of Britain in the Middle East, but I do believe that Tony Blair is our only hope in the future for bridging the gap between the United States and Europe. as well as the United States and the UK itself, and finally, between the United States and the Middle East. I think that he, right now, is a person who has the intelligence and can move forward thoughtfully and with a forward-thinking mindset. That is what we desperately need. And I don't think that's going to come from this administration in the U.S.
Why should this administration listen to or work with Tony Blair? What's the incentive for this newly elected administration, Barbara, in your judgment?
Well, I think that I think we will face continued failure. I think we will in the Middle East. The United States does not have an intelligent approach. UK's hands are not clean in this respect either. But I think that we are much more remiss in our diplomatic efforts or lack thereof. I don't think the skill is there. I don't think the mindset is there. I don't think that any of the pieces that need to be in place by this administration are there to approach any kind of solution. I believe that with that and the failure that will come from that, that the United States will be at much higher risk for failure across the board and across so many dimensions.
Barbara, let me just stop you there if I can. I want to turn to Timothy here with a question. I guess it's the same that Richard was talking about earlier in the program. What is the incentive for this newly elected Bush administration to listen to the point of view that Barbara's expressing and in turn that Tony Blair will be bringing to the Oval Office?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. And we were talking a moment ago about the need to have a stronger European Union position, because clearly Washington would have to listen to 460 million Europeans in the way it doesn't so much have to listen to 60 million Britons. But I think there are a couple of reasons here. First of all, the United States is in an almighty mess in Iraq, and you've got to find a way out of it. Secondly, President Bush, as many presidents in their second term, must be concerned with his place in history. And his place in history will depend on whether he has begun to win what he calls the war on terror, to reduce the threat of Islamist terrorism, to begin the enlargement of freedom in the wider Middle East. And he can only do that with the help not just of Blair, but of a great many others in Europe.
You start your book with the sentence, "When you say we, who do you mean?" That's the question about identifying or defining what the West is becoming.
Absolutely, and I would love to hear your listeners on this point, because you see, when I say we, I mean in the first place my family, my friends, maybe my town, my baseball team, my own country. But then the question is, what is the largest political community of which you instinctively say we? Now, I actually think a growing number of people, particularly younger people, are citizens of the world. I mean, their instinctive reaction, my own children's instinctive reaction, is to say we means all humankind. But there's something in between. It used to be the West. It used to be Europe and America, the anti-communist West, defining itself against the Soviet Union. And the question is, what is it now?
Let's take a call from Buies Creek, North Carolina. Mike's joining us on the phone from there. Hi, Mike. What is the we now? Can you help us with that one?
Well, yeah, I'd love to try expand the idea. And I think that the we in the West is becoming greater, more greatly divided than ever before.
Hey, Mike, I've got to let you go. I'm sorry. The telephone line that you're on is just not clear enough. We're only picking up every third word. Let's jump along to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Edward is on the line. Edward, can I put the same question to you, how we say that word we today, what it means?
Well, actually, I wanted to ask your guest a question, if perhaps he didn't think that part of Tony Blair's interest in establishing stronger ties with the U.S. is that, in fact, Britain's power within Europe has been decreasing over the last number of years. And if Britain had a stronger tie with the U.S., then that would, in fact, increase Tony Blair's and Britain's bargaining power with the European Union.
so that Blair really has a very particular self-interest in keeping alliances with the West as a way of keeping himself strong in talking to the rest of Europe, is it?
Exactly.
Timothy?
Well, you could argue it both ways. You could say that, you know, look, by siding with George Bush on Iraq, he seriously damaged his credibility in much of continental Europe, so there was a big loss there. On the other hand, yeah, sure, you have a bit more leverage if you are seen to have the in with Washington. So I think you can argue that both ways.
Edward, let me come back to you, though. I mean, do you think that the idea of the West as this historic alliance between Europe and America still exists? Edward, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear my question?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
I'm just asking you whether or not you think there is still a West that ties together America and Europe.
Yes, I think there absolutely is. And I thought your guest made a very astute comment when he indicated that this idea of power has much more than one dimension. And I personally think that the current administration focuses far too much on military power. There's much more to it than just that. And I think that this current administration would do a lot better to think more multidimensionally in many senses.
Timothy, Edward's comment puts me in mind of something that I was thinking as I read your book, and that is that if you put the question to people in America today, who's we, who's they, people in this country are more likely to answer that question in terms of the election that just took place and the divisions that exist in this country. It's become such a polarizing event. I wonder whether or not people are even interested in looking across the Atlantic.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, I think that is a huge problem since the end of the Cold War. And incidentally, these divisions are somehow connected. Republicans charged John Kerry with speaking French, a shameful thing, and even looking French. You know, in other words, Democrats are sort of honorary Europeans, and Europeans are honorary Democrats. And the divide actually goes, and you're absolutely right, bang through the middle of the United States and indeed through the middle of Europe and not down the middle of the Atlantic. What I want to say with this book is that it's up to us how we redefine this largest political community. Who are we is up to us. These are not set in stone. They are subjective. They are created by the minds and the actions of millions of citizens of Europe and the United States. And it's up to us to recreate the larger we.
It's interesting as well that people in this country for the past week or so have been so obsessed with trying to come to terms with the word values, because values became one of those dividing lines in on the ballot this time around. And you go directly at this question of values, but talking about Western values, the ones that we were raised on, freedom and human rights, democracy and the rule of law. Do you think that the basic understanding of what those values are is also starting to separate people?
No, absolutely not. I think it is demonstrably the case that there is not one sort of clear, coherent set of European values and one sort of block of American values, although many Europeans and Americans attempted to believe that. And actually, I have in the book a fascinating map drawn from something called the World Values Survey, which has surveyed what people's actual values are for 30 years, which shows that there aren't these two blocks of values. There are various clusters of countries, Catholic Europe, Protestant Europe, ex-communist Europe, with quite different values, and then the English-speaking world, with Britain closer to the United States and Canada. So it is simply untrue to say that Europe and America are divided along lines of values.
But probably very true to say that a lot of Europeans woke up last Wednesday to a new understanding of what Christian values can mean in political terms in this country.
Yes, but that, of course, is also true of much of blue America, which is equally alienated by the notion that, as one book title had it, God had a special plan for America. So that here, the extreme in the whole global spectrum of values and attitudes is actually the evangelical fundamentalist wing of Red America. But it's the extreme, I would say again, of a continuum.
1-800-423-8255, that's our number. Next to Medford, Massachusetts, Cliff's with us. Hi, Cliff.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think Bush is receiving Blair because Blair and Bush is only real reliable foreign ally in the war. They have a symbiotic relationship where they prop each other up. They've always shared a uniquely close relationship. I mean, George Bush is the, 18th great-grandson of Robert II of Scotland. They literally have some blood relatives if you go back far enough. I also think that...
And are you saying that that's a good thing for the countries then, Cliff? I mean, regardless of what today's political demands draw them together, is it a good thing for America and Britain and by extension Europe that they do have this need for each other?
Well, I don't know whether it's good or bad. I think it is, why they both receive each other. America separated from England back in the Revolutionary War, but with World War I, World War II, they've continued right up through today to move closer. Blair had Dr. Kelly suicided for Bush's weapons of mass destruction excuse for war, and they both serve the same oligarchy of New World bankers. If you go to Infowars.com, you can see that they go to Bohemian Grove, and these Christians worship Moloch and Baal. I mean, it's not good for the country, and they are very intimate and on the same agenda.
I want to jump across to Moline, Illinois, where Tevis is joining us on the line from there. Hi, Tevis.
Good morning.
Tell me what you think about the relationship.
Well, I want to put it in a little bit slightly different context. Europe and the United States, I believe, and I'm an American citizen and I love this country, but I believe that they are breaking apart, and I think that the separation is becoming very permanent. And I don't just put it at the feet of George Bush or Tony Blair or any other one thing. I think this has been happening slowly over a period of years, and I think it's inevitable. From everything I've heard and read, Europe is becoming truly the United States of Europe. Now, England hasn't decided to join that new United States of Europe, but they ought to. They're going to be left out in the cold if they don't.
Sounds to me, Tevis, like it doesn't matter that much to you if this separation occurs. Am I reading too much into that?
That's exactly right. I don't think Europe needs America. America probably needs Europe if they want to be a world power. But Europe is going to reaffirm itself as a world power, as one united voice, and that has happened. That's happening all the time. The opposition to George Bush's policies and the policies of the United States is just astounding the people in Europe, and understandably why. It's astounding half of the people in this country as well. Why Tony Blair ever joined into the coalition with the invasion of Iraq just astounds me. I have no understanding of what could have taken place that enabled that to happen.
Well, Tevis, just stay on the line. I'm going to let Timothy in here.
Yeah, I would really invite you to read my book if you think that the divorce is inevitable, because it most definitely is not. And by the way, it's not going to be the United States of Europe. The only people, it seems to me, who really believe that are actually the Americans who write about us as the United States of Europe.
What's wrong with that picture?
Most Europeans believe that. Well, it's a lovely idea, but the fact is, you have 25 very diverse countries speaking different languages, and we're going to have more, and you simply cannot make a single nation, a single state, out of 30, 35 vastly different countries stretching across a continent with hugely different histories.
Can you make the point, excuse me, Timothy, I'm just wondering if you can make the point to Tevis, who's still on the line, why it matters that the U.S. and whatever Europe is retain this.
Absolutely. Well, let me make two points, Tim. One is, it isn't only Tony Blair. It really is not. What I call the Euro-Atlanticists, the people who want a strong Europe as a partner for the United States, are actually the majority in Europe. Chirac represents the minority. And if you gave us a bit more encouragement, if the administration in Washington gave a bit more encouragement and had a wiser policy, then you could have the whole of the European Union as a partner to face the huge challenges, what I call the new red armies, that we face in the world today. Look, not just the threat of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, the state of the whole wider Middle East, the vast gulf between rich North and poor South, the fact that 3 billion people live on less than $2 a day, the rise of China, which is a vast challenge to us all, the undoubted fact of global warming and the contribution of greenhouse gases to it. You know, these are the real challenges of our time. This is the world we're in. And if the world in which our children is going to live is not going to be a much messier, nastier, and bloodier place, then Europe and America need to work together to tackle these things.
Tevis, are you hearing this idea of the America and Europe working together on everything from a war on poverty to a war on terror?
Yes, I agree with that. I agree that they should work together. Under the proper administration and the proper State Department, they would have worked together much better over the last 4 years and probably over the next four, like they used to in the good old days before Bush. But
if those were the good old days, you don't sound like you're that keen on going back to those days, Tevis.
I would love to go back to those days, but I don't think the world can turn back.
Huh.
But just to get to Europe again for a minute, Europe has a common currency now. That's a huge thing. They also have a common language, and their common language is English. And from what I've seen in my travels in Europe, you don't have people identifying themselves as Norwegians or Italians. They say, I'm a European. I'm from Norway.
I'm going to stop you there, Tevis. We have to take a short break. A reminder to our listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255 this hour, talking about the changing nature of the relationship between Europe and America, changed yet again by the results of that last week's election. Tony Blair is in Washington speaking with President Bush. We'll be hearing their remarks a little bit later on in the day. What difference is it going to make at this point to have those two men working together? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Timothy Garton Ash. He's author of a number of books of political writing. His new one is Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. He's joining us from a studio in Chicago this hour. Your number to join us, 1-800-423-8255. Before we go back to the calls, Timothy, I'd like to go just briefly on Tevis's last point. He's saying that there is a common language of Europe, it's English, that there is a common currency in Europe, and it's worth a lot more than the dollar, as people in this country are noting right now. But I'm wondering if there is a simple way of looking at Europe, or if that isn't part of the basic problem of the misunderstanding here.
You know, that's exactly right. I mean, by the way, when we say the common language is English, Václav Havel, the former Czech dissident and president, once said to me, you know, Tim, there are three kinds of English. There's the English that Czechs talk to French and Poles talk to Argentinians. There you understand 100%. There's American English. You understand 50%. And then he said, there's English, and you understand nothing. it is a curious thing to be English in this English-speaking world, because you realize that English has become a sort of curious dialect of itself. English is the working language of Europe. But if you go into the parliament, you have about 80 interpreters translating from Slovenian to Czech and Greek to Portuguese and Swedish to English. The politics of the European Union now work in 20 languages, and it's very, very difficult. This is not going to become a United States for that reason. And as you say, the result is that America is something very simple, big, vivid, strong. It's a sort of a big Cadillac. And Europe is something enormously diffuse and complicated. It's a sort of herbaceous border of all sorts of different plants, which are growing very, very slowly. And that's why I well understand that Americans don't get it. They don't see the point of it. They don't understand what it is. And yet it moves. And if you look at the story of the European Union over the last 60 years, it is the most amazing story of the enlargement of freedom. There's never been a time when most of the countries of Europe have lived in freedom and prosperity in the same political community.
And do you put Britain square in the middle of that or a little bit off to one side, as it is geographically?
I put Britain slap bang square at the heart of Europe, as does Tony Blair. Unfortunately, rather a lot of our compatriots disagree. And that's partly because they get a dose of what we call Euroscepticism, an extraordinarily distorted view of the European Union as a sort of Napoleonic plot to take over Europe by our ancient enemies, the French. And they get that view from, you know, the daily newspapers, which are owned by Rupert Murdoch and until recently the late unlamented Conrad Black.
1-800-423-8255. Hollis, New Hampshire, and Tim's on the line. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, good morning.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, I am a Brit. I'm a green card Brit, and I lived here maybe nine years now, and I truly love this country. My family, we've been brought up here as well. And until recently, I've always kind of held with the argument that it's not the Americans that are the problem, it's the American government that's a problem. And I'm genuinely starting to question that, because when I see the other half, the red half of this country, and the attitudes and the polarization, and particularly the emergence of the religious right as a power base, that's so alien, so different, so disturbing, and for a Brit. We're a secular people. Only about 2% of Brits ever go to church. To see that emerging genuinely makes me question whether this really is a place that I belong.
Well, what's the conclusion, Tim, that you didn't get it for the first 8 years and now you see the picture, or that this country really is changing?
Well, you know, I've traveled all over this country. I've actually, like I said, in 48 of the 50 states. And almost across the board, the Americans that I meet are delightful. I love them all. And yet, I see this bizarre change happening, which apparently at least half the country is way straight behind. And I'm living in some kind of bizarre fantasy world, or there really is a difference, I mean, an emerging, a changing difference, because I've been here 8-10 years, so you know, things change over 10 years. And if this really is going to become a religious, an annex of Tehran in a Christian way almost, that has so little overlap with any Europeans that I know, and I work for a German company, that's going to drive that rift much, much further and faster apart, because it's a mindset that simply doesn't work anymore in Europe.
Timothy, in a piece that you wrote recently for The Guardian, you expressed a view not unlike what we're just hearing from Tim here, that there is an option of sort of sitting back and going, oh my goodness, what is this? Let's watch it. It's almost like a reality television show that is America unfolding across the ocean. That's one of a number of options that you present for people trying to make sense of what this country is.
I think you have this terrible reality show Big Brother, and I say that this is the option of treating America as Big Brother, not George Orwell's Big Brother, but the reality show, and just sitting back and saying, watch this amazing show with, you know, Rummy and Cheney slagging it out and Condi and Laura, and does God have a plan for America? That will get us nowhere at all. It's completely useless. I would say to my compatriot and namesake, Tim, please don't lose faith with the other America. We have to keep faith with the other America. And the fact is, Dick, that if the Democrats had, in my view, a better candidate with more popular appeal in the South, he might have won the election, and then we would be giving a completely different interpretation of history. So I believe we Europeans, now more than ever, have to keep faith with the other America, and I'm firmly convinced that in 4 years' time we will see another face of America.
What do you think, Tim?
Lord, I hope that's true. I for my sins, when I'm not listening to you guys, I listen to local talk radio just because it makes me so mad, it keeps me awake. And when I hear the snarling lunacy that calls in and expresses opinions that would pass quite happily under totalitarian regimes, and these are regular guys, regular gals, who I don't meet, I have to tell you, I've never met these guys, but they're there, clearly.
Yeah, well.
If that's the growing thread, then yeah, we live in different planets. It's Mars and Venus.
Bear in mind, some of that is real and some of that is theater. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Manning, South Carolina for our next call. James is with us. Hi, James.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I guess I really want to support your commentator and take issue with some of the other callers that I've heard this morning. I think we in the United States need to realize the incredible value, transatlantic value and other, that the UK offers. I spent 16 years in Europe. I lived through the first Balkan War, the first Iraq War. I watched, children and mothers being garroted and burnt alive in houses in places like Mostar and the so-called safe havens while the European Defense Force kind of fiddle-farted around. I truly believe that it will be impossible in our generation to have a very constructed dialogue with the entirety of Europe because of the cultural divides that your commentator has mentioned. And Britain offers us this incredible advantage to have sort of a friend on the inside, if you will, that speaks with the same cultural values that we do and can provide us with the insights that we wouldn't be able to have otherwise.
James, how long have you lived in South Carolina?
I came back to South Carolina, where my family has resided since 1726 in 1996.
The reason I'm asking is I'm wondering if the view that you're expressing would be one that you'd find commonly shared with neighbors.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you something else funny. As your guest was talking about the World Values Survey, I was in my church last night, and we were having a discussion on C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, where he was talking about the laws of natural morality. So, I mean, these values are very deeply felt in a lot of different communities all over the United States. And as far to your caller just a moment ago, my apologies for the snarling right. There are a lot of Christians out there that do not like to be labeled that way, and we certainly feel your pain.
Timothy.
Can I just comment there, Dick, because this is such an important point. I mean, a problem you have and we have is media, which in an almost Orwellian way create a completely false reality. You remember in 1984, war is peace, freedom is slavery. And if you look at, Fox News's reporting from Iraq or indeed conservative talk radio, you are in a world where white is black, and Iraq is about to become a flourishing democracy. But and I think we have alternatives to that. One of them is programs like this one and NPR and indeed the BBC. But another is the internet. We actually do have this amazing place where people all over the world can talk to each other. And I actually have out of this book, Free World, a website. The address is freeworldweb.net, freeworldweb, one word, .net, where readers of the book and anyone else who wants to join in can come in and discuss what should we do about Bush, what should we do about the Middle East, what should we do about global warming. And there's an absolutely fascinating conversation developing on that website between people all over the world, so we don't have to submit to the hegemony of the Orwellian media.
Not very long ago, this Orwellian media was a very nationalistic media. I mean, even in Britain, in the United States, in world wars, in recent memory, these journalists wrote about us versus them. It's a part of the Stalin Red Peril that you describe in your book in the late 40s. What happened to shift people almost back to a more dramatic sense of us versus them in the moments after the 80s and the 90s when that didn't appear to be a problem?
Well, there was something in the 1990s after the end of the Cold War, something like nostalgia for the enemy. It was a very, the Cold War made things simple. There was us and there was them, and we were at war. And it was all very confusing, and people talked of globalization, but they didn't know quite where they stood. And then 9/11 happened, and I think, particularly in this country, a lot of people said, okay, now we know where we stand. There's us and them again. We're at war, and indeed Fox News television talks about our soldiers, our GIs. The essential thing for people like us who work with the word, whether in broadcasting or print, is to keep that essential division that fact is sacred and opinion is free. I don't mind people can have the wildest and most ranting opinions on the op-ed pages, but when it infects and distorts the news reporting, that's when we have the Orwellian problem.
Timothy, back at the end of the program here to the encounter between Bush and Blair, between America and Britain and Europe, how much is this relationship going to be changed or altered or affected in the years ahead by what happens in the months ahead in Iraq? How key is Iraq to understanding what lies ahead?
Well, if Iraq descends into civil war, which was one of the CIA's three possible scenarios, then Blair could still lose the election in May. It's as important as that for him. If it doesn't, I think he will win it. If it descends into civil war and becomes the recruiting ground and hotbed for terrorism, which it actually wasn't under Saddam Hussein, then, as many of us fear, this has been the most disastrous mistake the West has made in the early 21st century, and the world in which we all live will be a much more dangerous place.
Timothy, nice to have you on the program. Thanks for your time.
Great pleasure.
Timothy Garton Ash. His new book is called Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. A little bit earlier in the program, we had a chance to speak with Richard Wolff, Washington correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diana Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Our website is www.theconnection.org, and we will have a link there to Free World Net that Timothy spoke about. It's just one of the websites associated with his work. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Action.